Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In a week of bad news on the economy, more bad news on the economy. The government this morning, as you just heard from NPR News, lowered its estimate of economic growth in the second quarter, that's April to June, from a 2.4% annual growth rate to just 1.6%. That means we are closer to a double-dip recession, two quarters of shrinkage rather than growth makes a recession, than previously thought. At very least, it signals more bleak job prospects. Typically, according to Paul Krugman's column today, more than 2.5% growth is needed to create enough jobs to reduce unemployment. The revision comes in the same week as dismal numbers for home sales and starts and the report of almost 500,000 new jobless claims. And this comes as Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is about to give a much-anticipated speech on the economy, with politicians and economists divided over what he should say and do. We will have three guests on this now, beginning with Ross Duvall, Director of Economic Research at the Milken Institute think tank in Santa Monica, California. His op-ed in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal was called The Case for Economic Optimism. Mr. Duvall, thanks for coming on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Yes, hello from Santa Monica, California. And Brian, it's a pleasure to be on your show this morning.
Your article was written before at least some of these bad numbers came out. Are you still making a case for economic optimism?
Yeah, I still make the case for economic optimism. I'm also a realist. The latest data has been somewhat disappointing. But nevertheless, I still believe that there is underlying strength, and we have dwelled too much on the pessimistic case. Certainly, people should take a look at the economy and give their honest assessment. But my biggest fear is that businesses are going to be reluctant to invest in hire. And one of the main reasons is because we've been talking them out of it.
So what we do in the media and what the kind of professional business class says to itself actually affects the economy?
Yes, it certainly does. It affects business confidence. The biggest challenge I think that we face right now in the economy overall is the confidence of small businesses and access to bank credit. Small businesses have had a very difficult time getting access to bank credit, whether it's to expand or to hire, and we need to loosen that up. And I think the Fed needs to play a role in encouraging regulators that some risk is necessary in a market economy.
So, for example, we heard a clip in the news from Alan Blinder, the former Fed vice chairman, who, if I understood the soundbite correctly, called for more monetary easing. Is that what you're saying? And how much more easy money could the Fed create with interest rates for the banks already near zero?
Well, I think Blinder's point is that he would eliminate interest payments on reserves held at the Fed to encourage banks to get that back out there in the private sector and lend it. That's certainly something that could be utilized. I'm not suggesting expansive monetary policy, but I think there's certainly a number of things that we could do from the federal fiscal side, which I have already outlined in my op-ed piece.
Such as?
Such as. One of the things we could do is to modernize export controls on technology products and services to some countries such as Israel, India, China, and other developing countries, which really suffer from a Cold War mentality. Many of our allies sell a lot of technology products to China, for example, that we restrict. And in fact, Taiwan sells a lot of high-tech products to China that we refuse to sell to them. So that's certainly something that we could do to help the export sector and help spur job growth.
And you use exports as a whole and the company Caterpillar in particular as an example of Asia helping the U.S. economy already, as an example of the optimism that you're trying to express into the teeth of all this doom and gloom, correct?
Yes, certainly. We've seen very strong growth in Asia. China is still growing in excess of 10%. You have India growing somewhere around 8%. So we've already seen strong demand for U.S. products in Asia. Caterpillar, any company in the U.S. that sells heavily to Asia and to other developing markets, has been doing much better than the rest of the U.S. economy. So any company that has a lot of overseas exposure, especially to Asia, has seen better results.
But isn't even China facing lowered expectations now?
Certainly China is facing lower expectations. The central government has been attempting to slow the economy because they felt that it was growing too quickly and would lead to inflationary pressures. So they have been restricting bank lending, but we're talking about moving from near 12% growth to somewhere around 10%. So still very strong growth, although certainly slowing.
Back to your case for optimism, you cite Fed Chairman Bernanke's somewhat optimistic prediction of 3 to 3.5% economic growth this year. Do you believe that number? Do you think he still believes that number after today's downgrading of the second quarter to 1.6%, just half that rate?
The second quarter GDP report certainly makes that number more difficult to achieve. It was revised down to 1.6%, as we've heard. But what's interesting, it seems to me, is the main reason why that number was revised down so much is because the import growth was an exceptional rate, which is a subtraction from GDP. Imports grew over 32% at an annual rate. If you just look at real gross domestic purchases, that's purchases by U.S. residents of goods and services wherever they're produced, they increased at an annual rate of 4.9% in the second quarter, much stronger than the first quarter. So there's still some we have to look at the import numbers and understand that they went somewhere. They either went in inventories or they were sold. But nevertheless, certainly the second quarter revisions make it more difficult. However, there are some silver linings in here. If you look at business investment in equipment and software in the second quarter, it rose at an annual rate of 24.9%. So businesses that had deferred investment in information technology, services, and other equipment have been making those purchases, and I think that's one of the factors that has led to manufacturing growth in the U.S.
I'm just looking at a Wall Street Journal dispatch from the last few minutes as Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, gets ready to give that speech that's being closely watched. The journal says, "Treasuries fell today after a revision of U.S. economic growth for the second quarter beat market forecasts, easing the demand for safe assets." In other words, more people want the very safe Treasury bills, so their yields fell. The report offered a dose of relief for market participants as weak data over the past few days, including home sales and durable goods, has added to anxiety about the economic outlook. Investors are eagerly awaiting a speech by Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke, which is starting around now, for further guidance on the economy and policy responses. So why did the journal say the report offered a dose of relief? I thought it's bad to downgrade the growth estimate for the spring from 2.5% to 1.5%?
It certainly is bad. There's no question about that. I think it's more of one of expectations, kind of the whisper numbers on the street were that the number could have even been below 1% in the annual rate. So there was some relief, possibly, that it wasn't as bad as anticipated, and I believe yields have gone up a little bit. So in other words, there's less risk aversion than one might have thought the market was expecting yesterday.
What do you want to hear from Bernanke in his speech this morning, and what do you think you will hear?
What I want to hear from him is that the Fed is working with the banking sector to make sure that creditworthy borrowers are getting access to capital. I think that's been one of the factors that has clearly restrained growth in the small business sector, and that's where the majority of jobs are created. And if we really want to get the economy moving, we have to have small businesses creating jobs and taking risks again. So I think Alan Blinder's suggestion that the Fed probably ought to stop paying interest on reserves held at the Fed is probably a good idea to start that happening. And talking to bank examiners and making them aware that certainly we had a bubble that developed with loose credit, but we've probably gone too far in the opposite direction.
Ross Duvall, Director of Economic Research at the Milken Institute Think Tank in Santa Monica, his op-ed in Wednesday's Wall Street Journal is called "The Case for Economic Optimism." Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
We do not have the luxury of waiting months for the president to pick scapegoats for his failing stimulus policies. We tried 19 months of government as community organizer, and it hasn't worked. Our fresh start needs to begin now.
So after all this buildup and hype, all we know is what John Boehner and his Republican colleagues are against. I know what they're against. What I don't know, other than a tax cut for the top 2% of the taxpayers in America, I don't know what they're for.
Republican House Leader John Boehner responded to there by Vice President Joe Biden. More on the economy now, with the various dreary numbers out all week on jobs, housing, and this morning's downward revision of second quarter growth to 1.6%. With me now are economic journalist Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon, finance blogger for Reuters. Hi, Heidi. Hi, Felix. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Hi, Fran.
And listeners, if you want to weigh in on any of this, if you have an opinion about, I don't know how many Americans actually sit around with opinions on what the Federal Reserve Chairman should say, but if you're one of those people, we want to hear from you right now. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or make your case for optimism or pessimism or particular policy prescriptions. Were you listening? What did you either of you think of Ross DeVos' argument for optimism? Is he right about too much media doom and gloom, Heidi?
I think that he is onto something in that it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy when people start to believe that the economy is bad. It tends to check their actions. They don't invest as much in things that might, obviously consumer spending or in homes or things like that. People tend to hoard money and companies tend to hoard money. So he's right that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, but at the same time, we do have a record unemployment rate and things look pretty bad, and that's a reality that we're still confronting.
Felix, same question.
I think it's a little bit much to blame the media for the bad economy. I mean, as Heidi points out, we have...
And he says it's not just the media. It's the media. It's the captains of industry. It's the political leaders of both parties.
Well, I mean, industry's not doing too badly. Corporate profits are up okay, and it's got, you know, companies have quite a lot of cash. The problem with the economy, I think, is that... you know, there are just far too many people out of work, and the economy is not built for 10%-ish unemployment rate. So that's worrying, and that's why people aren't spending, is because they don't have jobs, and you can't spend money if you're not earning money. That said, I think there are little snippets of light which we can draw even out of today's GDP report. We saw a lot of the reason why it went down or was revised down was because we were buying more stuff, weirdly, but we were buying it from abroad, so imports went up. And by the way, the GDP is calculated when imports go up a lot, GDP goes down. Huh. But that's buying stuff. And Ben Bernanke this morning has been making noises about, look, if things continue to stay bad and sluggish, then we will go back to our arsenal and start doing more of the unconventional monetary policy, which we were doing last year. So I'm hopeful that we're not going to have a massive big double dip crash, or, you know, as hopeful as I can be. But this is the real economy we're talking about here. It's not just, oh, we don't have enough animal spirits. We're not enthusiastic enough.
Now, let's see. We're getting... Oh, before I do this, you know, he's not the only optimist, Ross DeVos. We had Greg David this week, former editor of Crain's New York Business, now a business journalism professor at CUNY, saying this about the New York economy.
Well, I'm sorry, but we're doing great, to be frank. First of all, the Great Recession nationally. We lost 8.4 million jobs. In New York, depending on how you count, we lost 160,000. On percentage terms, we lost half the percent. Our loss here is half what the rest of the nation is. We got really strong numbers last week. So far this year, New York has gained 77,000 jobs. In July alone, the gain in New York accounts for one-fifth of all the jobs gained in the whole country.
So pretty definitive and so upbeat from Greg David. Heidi, you live around here. Have you looked at New York versus the nation as a whole?
Yeah, I've lived around here my whole life, actually, and it's true. New York is doing well, but New York is designed to do well, and you can't, and just because of the way that New York is, you can't tell when people are really suffering. Because when you go out in Manhattan or in Brooklyn, Brownstone, Brooklyn, I mean, everyone is sort of prosperous, everyone is educated, and that's not the problem in New York, and it's not the problem in the rest of the country. It's more sort of the working class and the lower class and the quickly disappearing middle class and what's going on with them. So while we may be sort of fulfilling certain measures of success and the numbers might be on our side, people are still looking for jobs in New York and elsewhere.
Anything on that from you, Felix?
Heidi's right. The problem with unemployment in New York is not among the college graduate doctors and lawyers and even bankers who seem to all have pretty good jobs.
Well, even all of those sectors are just a piece of the New York economy, right? New York
right.
is not
and
Manhattan and Brownstone, Brooklyn.
New
only.
York, when you're talking about the amount of jobs that New York has gained or that it lost during the recession, it's worth remembering that it had a pretty high unemployment rate going into the recession, among the less skilled. And certainly unskilled wages in New York are much, much lower than you really need to be able to live in this city. So there's big structural problems in New York which need to be dealt with and no one's really grappling with. But that's not particularly connected to the problems in the broader economy as a whole.
Well, let's take a phone call. Here is Steve in the aforementioned Manhattan. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hello. Steve, are you there? All right, we'll try to get back to Steve. How about Larry in Manhattan? Larry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Good morning, Brian. Supposedly during the Eisenhower administration, when this country had its greatest prosperity, we were taxing the upper 2% of the population at a 90% tax rate. What I would like to see you do one day is do an investigative report show where you correlate the monies given to our politicians by the top 2% of our population and the corporations, so we can finally see who is getting what, who in our government is getting what money from whom, and then do a correlation of their policies related to those top 2% and those corporate leaders.
Thank you very much. Felix, you want to react to that at all?
One of the big debates which is going on right now is the debate over Social Security as the Capped Food Commission starts looking to bring our fiscal situation into balance as the government starts worrying about how much money it has to borrow every year. A lot of right-wing eyes in particular are looking towards Social Security as a place where they might be able to save some money and make some cuts. And this speaks exactly to that what we've had of late is people paying a lot less income tax than they really need to pay in order to support the government spending, and instead much higher payroll taxes, which get paid by everybody rather than income taxes, which only get paid by the middle classes. And that's, a function of a lot of the inherent pressures in politics. You want to reduce income taxes on the people you hang out with and your donors, and then allow payroll taxes and everyone else to be in surplus and to rise. And now that's come to an end. Social Security is not in surplus anymore, and now they're saying, oh, well, now we're not living off you relatively poor payroll tax people. We have to cut back on what you're going to receive, and that seems a bit distasteful to me.
We're talking about the economy, the new numbers out this week, and a speech that Ben Bernanke is giving right now with economy journalist Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon. And here's the news, because we are now getting excerpts from the Bernanke speech that he's giving out west. And he says the focus of his speech is monetary policy. And he says we will continue to monitor economic developments closely and to evaluate whether additional monetary easing would be beneficial. In particular, the committee is prepared to provide additional monetary accommodation through unconventional measures if it proves necessary, especially if the outlook were to deteriorate significantly. So, Heidi, put that into English for us. What are these unconventional monetary accommodations that the Fed chairman might have in mind?
Uh, I, well, your guess is as good as mine. I think only Ben Bernanke knows. And I think that it actually, sort of the larger point around that is we are coming back to this idea that plagued us during the Greenspan years of the Fed chairman as Santa Claus, you know, that somehow he can just reach into his bag of gifts and make everything okay for everybody. And in his speech, Bernanke actually seems to be feeding that a little bit with this whole idea of, you know, the magical stimulus measures that he still hasn't pulled out. And what we're losing sight of is that there is, there has been historically and there should be rationally only a limited number of things that the Fed can do about the economy. We shouldn't have that much power in one central agency or bank. And also, we shouldn't blame that one central agency or bank when not everything goes according to plan. I mean, Ben Bernanke can control interest rates, right? Occasionally, he can pump money into banks, which is a new thing that happened during the crisis. But he can't fix unemployment. He can't fix trade deficits. He can't do anything about corporate spending. And he has very little impact on Wall Street besides interest rates. And so I think we kind of need to scale back and get a sense of reality about what the Fed can do and not allow ourselves to become so optimistic that, you know, he has this bag of sparkle dust that he's going to spread over everything.
Well, I wonder how much you agree with that, Felix, because Bernanke in the speech, and I'm going to read another couple of lines here, seems to talk back to those who say he doesn't have any sparkle dust. In fact, we heard that Alan Blinder clip earlier, Fed vice chairman from previous times, and he had a big op-ed yesterday in the Wall Street Journal with the very headline, "The Fed is running low on ammo." And Bernanke says in the speech just a couple of minutes ago, "The issue at this stage is not whether we have the tools to help support economic activity and guard against disinflation. We do. As I will discuss next, the issue is instead whether, at any given juncture, the benefits of each tool in terms of additional stimulus outweigh the associated costs or risks of using the tool." So we'll wait for the next highlight when he says what these tools actually are. But could you fill in that blank? That's the headline so far, to my eye, from the Bernanke speech that he's giving now. We do have tools to stave off disinflation and otherwise help the economy.
Right. And what he's talking about there broadly is printing money. He's saying that I'm the central bank. I have control of the printing presses. And if I want, I can go out there and, famously, as he used to once say, drop money from helicopters onto, you know, the American population. And they don't literally drop money from helicopters, although that, I would love to see that. It would be very, very fun. What they do is they do operations where they buy treasury bonds or they buy mortgage-backed bonds, and they pump money into the economy that way. And they have done that in the past, and they have stopped not doing that. They're sort of at an even keel on that front right now. And anytime they want, they can start pumping as much money as they like into the economy, which is naturally inflationary and helps at the margin. Now, that said, Heidi has a point that, you know, in times like this, it's not clear how easy or how possible it is to get inflation expectations rising again and get a little bit of growth and momentum just by printing money. We're in, you know, the Japanese have tried it and failed, and it's harder than it looks. But Bernanke does seem to be confident that if he wants to go out there and print lots of money, he can, and that that will make a difference.
And he's now articulating some of those unconventional measures. One, purchase more securities, as it is doing already. That's the government buying stocks. I'll ask you to explain that one to me. Change communications to investors, that is, how long will interest rates remain low, and reduce interest rates paid on bank reserves, which can affect how much money is in the system. I guess that is how much banks feel they can afford to lend. So anything new there to you, Heidi? Anything really unconventional?
No, not really. I mean, it is a toolbox that has expanded since just in the past year or 2 years since the financial crisis. But I think that it's interesting that so much of it is about so much of the Fed's response is not just printing money, as Felix said, and I, you know, that's really no sort of tool. It's just a way to push off the future. But another thing that the Fed does is take everything onto its own balance sheet, right? So it does more buying, and you know, it bought up toxic mortgages. It buys up, you know, more treasuries. It buys up, you know, stocks and other securities. And what that has done is not only have we centralized financial power at the level of the Federal Reserve, but the Federal Reserve is now has this bloated balance sheet full of all of the other stuff that it's too dangerous for other people to own. And that's a really dangerous collateral issue, because the only thing that supports the Fed right now is the fact that people believe in the United States, that we have a good credit rating, that we have kind of the faith of the world. But if Moody's or S&P or one of the ratings agencies decides that that's no longer proportional to our actual ability to pay our bills, you know, the whole Potemkin village falls apart.
Right.
You know, we end up with this giant bloated balance sheet and nothing behind it but confidence, and it just makes us look as a country incredibly badly collateralized.
And so what does it mean when he says the Fed could purchase more securities? Felix, we're almost out of time, but is that the government buying stocks? I've heard that some people express concern that would be the government tipping the scales on the private markets, which is not a good thing.
And so far, the Fed hasn't quite gone as far as buying stocks, but it could. There's no reason why it can't do that.
Why would it?
It would do it to try and pump more money into the stock market, into the economy, get people moving again, and, you know, as Heidi says, take a lot of risk onto its own balance sheet so that frees up the risk-taking appetites of the rest of the economy. I think the economy would need to deteriorate a lot more from present levels, though, before the Fed started doing that. It's, we're still growing. We would need to be in the double dip, and we would need to see some big stock market declines before the Fed did anything as drastic as buying equities.
So far, it looks like Wall Street is shrugging. I think I see single number increases in the Dow and the NASDAQ going by me on a monitor here, so I guess they're going to take this in as Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke continues to speak and lay out his alternatives for continuing to help the economy. And we thank economy journalists Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon, finance blogger for Reuters, for chiming in on all this today and explaining so much of it for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Cheers, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Remember 5 years ago when Hurricane Katrina started and ended, and then one of the infamous lines of the Bush administration when the president said, heck of a job, Brownie, about the head of FEMA, who was not really doing a heck of a job. We will visit FEMA 5 years later in a minute as we approach this fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. What has changed at FEMA? Is it doing a heck of a job today?